Okay, so yes, the title of the talk is Steering to the Deep, just like the retreat title itself, Steering to the Deep. But I thought it'd be good to start actually in the shallows. Or in fact, let's actually start the talk on the shore itself. So I want you to imagine a man sat down on the sand, sat down on the sand on the shore of an island. And it's not a desert island, it's not some kind of barren, uninhabited rock jutting out the sea. Now this is a lush island. It's lush with vegetation. So all kinds of amazing flowers are growing on this island. All kinds of ripe fruits hanging in the trees. And this island is presided over, is governed by a goddess. A beautiful goddess whose name is Calypso. And Calypso dwells in a great cavern on this island, and she sits every day beside a blazing fire, singing beautiful songs and weaving on a loom with a golden shuttle. And not only is Calypso the governess of this island, she is also the man's lover. So every night they retreat to a recess in this cavern, and they spend the night in each other's loving embrace. So it sounds like a paradise, doesn't it? And yet, every day, the man makes his way down to the shore, sits down on the sand, and he tortures himself with tears and groans and heartaches, and he looks out with streaming eyes across the watery wilderness that lies before him. So why is that? It's because he's not free. He's not free. So he's washed up onto this island in a terrible storm as he was making his way home from the great battle of Troy. And now, no matter how many false, flattering words Calypso might whisper in his ear, he can do nothing but think of making his way home, returning to his homeland. And his homeland is the rocky island of Ithaca. So Ithaca, where this man is king, and where his true queen, the noble Penelope, is waiting for him to return. So some of you will be familiar with that scene and with this character. So it's drawn from the epic Greek poem by Homer called The Odyssey. And the man's name is Odysseus. And as soon as I was asked to give a talk on this theme of steering to the deep, it was the Odyssey that immediately came to mind. Because in the Odyssey we've got an epic sea voyage. It's the archetypal epic sea voyage of Odysseus' return to Ithaca. But even if you've never heard of the Odyssey, even if you've never read the Odyssey, you might still have felt that as I was describing that scene of the man sat on the shores of an island, that there was something familiar to you. Something sounded familiar. And perhaps that was because Odysseus's situation there has some quite strong resemblance to scenes from the life story of the Buddha, at least symbolically speaking. So mythologized accounts of the Buddha's life story, they have him as a prince. A prince living in a palace, married to a beautiful woman. And it was predicted when he was born that he would become either a great king or a holy man. And his father, wanting him to be a king, decided to fill the palace with all kinds of pleasures to keep him there. So fine foods, lotus ponds, racing horses, dancing girls, all there to keep the Buddha in the palace. But like Odysseus, Siddhartha, as the Buddha was known before he became enlightened, he was not happy. He was not content with that situation. There was a longing in him, a longing for something more meaningful, something more valuable in his life. And it was that that sparked his quest for more meaning, sparked his quest that culminated in him becoming enlightened some 2,500 years ago. Now, even if you've never read the Odyssey or heard the life story of the Buddha, it might be that as I'm describing these two accounts, these two scenes, there's still something that is familiar to you. And I think there's something familiar in those stories that sound familiar to you because they're saying something really important about our basic human condition. They're saying something about our existential situation. So I bet we've all felt at some point in our lives, sometimes perhaps really acutely, a sense of discomfort, a sense of dissatisfaction, a sense of frustration with our lives, maybe a sense of not being quite at home, maybe a sense of being trapped, or a feeling of a need for more meaning, more value, and a longing for that, a longing for something more. And we experience that, according to the teaching of the Buddha, because we are not free. So we're also stranded on an island. We're also stranded on an island far from home. We're trapped within a palace, filled with superficial pleasures, but we're trapped there. Or to put it in more traditional Buddhist language, we feel that sense of being limited or restricted, bound even, because what binds us are the 10 fetters. So there's this Buddhist teaching of the 10 fetters that bind us, stop us being free. Now, I'm not going to go into all 10 of those fetters. I'm just going to say something about the first three. Because it said that with the breaking of the first three fetters, we, again to use the traditional language, enter the stream. So we become stream entrants. And that is that enlightenment becomes guaranteed. It's sure to follow in future. But we have to break the first three fetters to get to that point of irreversibility. So what are the first three fetters? The first fetter is the fetter of fixed self-view. Fixed self-view. So this is holding the view that we, as we are now, are how we will always be. So we might change a little bit, we might get more grey hair, that kind of thing, but essentially we stay the same throughout our lives. So when we're bound by this fetter, we refuse to accept, or we can't see, that we change, and that actually we can consciously change in particular ways. So we see ourselves instead as being this particular kind of person with these particular likes and dislikes. We see the world in this particular way, and that can't or won't change. Another way of putting this would be to say that when we're bound by the first fetter, the fetter of fixed self-view, we're merely creatures of habit. So we just go along in the same habitual ways as we've always done. So that's the first fetter. The second fetter is the fetter of doubt or indecision. So this isn't doubt in the intellectual sense, in the sense of a kind of critical, discerning type of doubt. It's doubt in the sense of being unwilling to commit to anything, of being incapable of making decisions about our life, about the course of our life. So you could say it's the maintenance of a kind of vagueness and an unhelpful kind of keeping of the options open. And usually that's because we're afraid of making a decision, making a commitment. The third fetter, and this is a bit more wordy, is attachment to ethical rules and religious observances. So attachment to ethical rules and religious observances. And being bound by this fetter means, in a Buddhist context, adopting certain Buddhist practices, like, for example, living by the five ethical precepts, meditation, puja, listening to talks, but regarding them as ends in themselves. So regarding them as ends in themselves rather than as means to an end. So that end being enlightenment, liberation. So all Buddhist practices are designed to liberate us, But we can get attached to them in unhelpful ways. So we can use them for ends for which they're not intended. So for example, we might practice meditation because we think it makes us look like a spiritual person and therefore more attractive, something like that. But if we do that, then we are misusing Buddhist practices. And if we treat Buddhism like that, then it becomes a fetter. So the third fetter of attachment to ethical rules and religious observances. So they're the three fetters then, the first three fetters: fixed self-view, doubt or indecision, and attachment to ethical rules and religious observances. And if in our lives, like I said, we've ever felt that sense of dissatisfaction, of discomfort, of frustration, if we've felt trapped and restricted, or if we've felt our lives lack meaning and purpose, then it's because we're bound by the fetters, and we need to break them, starting with those first three. The good news is that they can be broken. So Sangharakshita, who founded the Triratna Buddhist community, he says that, and this is a quote, "Breaking the three fetters should be a practicable possibility for anyone within the present lifetime." So breaking the three fetters should be a practicable possibility for anyone within the present lifetime. He goes on to say, once this point has been reached, one can only rise higher and ever higher on the path. So I find that encouraging. It is possible to break these fetters, and it is a realistic aim for everyone in the present life. But in order for that to happen, we need to resolve to break these first three fetters. So to put it more poetically, we need, like the Buddha, to leave the palace. We need to leave the lotus pools and the racing horses, and we need to go forth from the palace. Or to use the image of Odysseus, we need to leave behind the shores of the enchanted island and embark on an epic voyage, an odyssey. And in the words of the theme of our Rome retreat, we need to start steering to the deep. But what does that actually mean? So we can use that language, we can talk about steering to the deep. But let's just be a little bit more practical for a moment, a little bit more down to earth. What does that actually mean? Well, to me, it means quite simply practicing the Dharma, practicing Buddhism, practicing the Buddha's teaching. So I'm sure you all know that after the Buddha went forth from the palace, went forth from home and became a wandering ascetic, spent many years practicing different spiritual teachings of the time, and at one point he sits down underneath the Bodhi tree and he fully wakes up. He breaks all the fetters. And after his enlightenment, he didn't just stay there, he went and taught others the way to experience that for themselves, to realize that for themselves. And in doing that, he offered people certain practices. He offered them a training or a discipline, technically known as the Dharma Vinaya. And often we refer to it simply as the Dharma. And this training, this way of life, this set of practices is still available to us. So we can still take it up. And if we've taken it up, we can still deepen our practice of it. And we can deepen our practice of it in a way that helps us to move towards breaking those fetters. But this gives rise to another question, doesn't it? So what then is the Dharma? What is Dharma practice? What is Dharma life? What are its qualities? And that's not a new question. So it's been asked throughout the ages. And it was asked of the Buddha as well. And often the Buddha would give descriptions of the Dharma. He would give descriptions of the qualities of the Dharma. And in one particular teaching in the Udana, which has been the inspiration for this weekend retreat, the Buddha describes Dharma practice as being comparable to a mighty ocean. So he speaks of the Dharma as a mighty ocean. And he went on to describe in a text in the Udana, one of the earliest sets of Buddhist teachings, 8 particular qualities of Dharma practice that are comparable to the qualities of a mighty ocean. So I'm going to spend the rest of the talk going through these 8 qualities. Because what the Buddha gives, I think, is a really useful description of how to effectively practice the Dharma. So he describes some really essential principles. But not only that, he also says something about what we might expect to encounter as a result of practicing the Dharma. So he says something about what we might encounter as we voyage further into the depths of reality, as we move away from being fettered. So I'll deal with those 8 qualities in 2 sets. So the first 4 qualities, I think, have more practical implications for us. They give us a bit more information about what the Dharma is and how to practice it effectively. But then the latter 4 qualities, to me, to my mind at least, seem to say something more about what we might expect to encounter as a result of our practice. So the first 4 more to do with steering, the last 4 more to do with the deep. So let's start with the first 4 qualities then. So number 1, the Buddha says that the great ocean flows down and slides down gradually. So he says there's no abrupt precipice as you make the transition from land to sea. And similarly, he says, with Dharma practice, the training, the path, is also gradual. So it slopes down little by little, and there's no abrupt penetration of knowledge. So here the Buddha is saying that training in the Dharma is gradual. It takes time. And this would make sense, wouldn't it? Because becoming skilled at anything takes time, takes practice. And perhaps we shouldn't expect immediate results. But it also makes sense if we think back to the first fetta. So the fetta of a fixed self view or of habitual action. So if we are fettered by old habits, if we're fettered by bad habits, it's going to take time to change those habits. It'll take time because we need to know what they are. We need to actually find out what our habits are. It'll take time because we then need to reflect on what those habits are. We need to see what triggers them. We need to take responsibility for them. And we need to work to overcome them, probably by creating new, more positive habits. And all of that takes time. It's a gradual process. It's a gradual process of integrating ourselves, getting to know ourselves. So we have particular practices to help with that. So mindfulness is really crucial. So we can practice mindfulness all the time, when we're eating, when we're walking, when we're sitting, when we're lying down. We can be mindful of our bodies. We can be mindful of our feelings, our thoughts, our emotions. And meditation too, I think, is particularly useful. So we can do a practice like the mindfulness of breathing, and we can see where our minds habitually go. And by encouraging the mind to come back to the breath, to rest on the breath, we gradually train it to become more integrated, more concentrated, less disintegrated and distracted. And I also think sangha and community and friendship are really important as well, in helping us to get to know ourselves better. Sometimes a friend can see our habits more than we can see them ourselves, and can kindly, appropriately help us to see them too. But all of these practices take time. So they take time, first of all, to establish and integrate them into our lives, and then they take time to have an effect. So, as the Buddha says, let's see Dharma practice as a gradual process, not expect results too quickly. I think the key word here, the key principle that we can draw out of what the Buddha's saying is persistence. So if, as the Buddha says, training in the Dharma is gradual, then we need to be persistent and not give up. So the second quality of Dharma practice that resembles the mighty ocean is that the great ocean is of a stable nature. The ocean doesn't overpass its boundary. And the Buddha says that similarly, his followers, his disciples, don't transgress the path of training. So they stay within its boundaries. So here the Buddha's pointing out that the Dharma practice, has a certain shape. There are boundaries. It has a certain structure. And the Buddha's suggesting that it's good to have this. It's good to stay within those boundaries. It's a quality of the Dharma life. And within the Triratna community, we have a particular framework. We have a particular structure that's been given to us, that's been taught to us by Sangharakshita, drawing on essential core Buddhist teachings. And I think this retreat's a really good example of that. So this morning we chanted the refuges and the five precepts. So we all practice those five precepts, aspire to practice those precepts. We're doing specific meditation practices, so mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana. We're engaging in study on the retreat, so talks, and we'll have discussion groups. There'll be a ritual element of the retreat, so we had dedication ceremony last night, puja tonight. And then the retreat also has periods of time where we can connect with each other more deeply, make connections, build friendships. And then within Triratna, there are other emphases as well, so work of spiritual practice, exploring the arts and culture, that kind of thing. So that framework isn't random. It's deliberately set up like that. All the practices hang together and have a coherence. So there are different practices that engage different parts of us. So it might engage our rational minds, our emotional being, our imagination. And it's good to stay within that framework, to recognize what that framework is and to stay within that framework. Practice it in its full range. Not just doing the bits we like, the bits we don't like. So Vidyavachan encouraged us last night to come to everything. I think he said to plunge into everything. So based on this second quality then that the Buddha describes, I think we can deduce that steering to the deep requires specific practices. So that's two guidelines now, persistence and structure. So thirdly, the Buddha says that the great ocean rejects a dead body. If a dead body is cast into the ocean, then the ocean throws it up on the shore. And he says, in the same way, the Sangha, the spiritual community, rejects someone who is not really practicing the spiritual life. So it's quite strong language from the Buddha on this point. I think the basic point is that we can't just be a nominal member of the Sangha, a spiritual community. So we can't just make up the numbers. We can't just come and look pretty. We can't be an ornamental Buddhist. So obviously you could just turn up and sit without engaging with what's going on. And I don't think anyone would literally come and chuck you out. But although you'd be here physically, you wouldn't really be here at all, in one sense. Because if we're not engaged with what we're hearing, what we're practicing, if we're not engaged with that, then the Dharma can't have any effect on us. So we might as well not be here in that respect. Of course, I'm not saying that people aren't welcome to come and join the Sangha and explore what's going on and see what's going on for themselves. But if we come and we stay but we don't really engage, then it's not going to have an effect on us. So what the Buddha's implying here is that you have to make an effort to free yourself from the fetters that bind you. Nobody else can do that for you. So of course we can have spiritual friends, they can support us, they can offer advice and guidance, but they can't actually do the work for you. So they can't steer to the deep for you. You have to steer there yourselves. So I think the key word here is engagement. So steering to the deep, effective Dharma practice is persistent, it's structured, and it's engaged. So the fourth quality of Dharma practice that's comparable to the mighty ocean. The Buddha says that just as when rivers reach the ocean, they lose their former names and lineages. So the river Ganges, for example, when it reaches the sea, it loses its name and just becomes the great ocean. So too, when somebody goes forth and adopts the training taught by the Buddha, they abandon their former names and lineages. So for some of us, our voyage into the deep has included giving up former names. So the order members here all have new names. But I don't think we have to take what the Buddha's saying here quite as literally as that, as just referring to that. I think that's just one example or one expression of an underlying principle, an underlying attitude. And that's the principle of being willing to give things up. So willing to give things up or let go of things in order to transform from what we are now into something else. So that process of transformation, that process of growth and unfoldment, it will require some element, some degree of giving things up, of letting go of things. So in traditional language, renunciation. And the Buddha was the exemplar of this. So the Buddha literally went forth from home into a homeless life, shaved off his hair and beard, put on a rag robe, went forth to become a forest dweller, begging for food in villages. No possessions, or at least very few, no career, no status of any kind. Now, we can't do it like that. So if we shaved off our hair and beard, put on a rag robe, put on your bed sheet or something, went off into the village of Serlingham with a bowl from the Padmaloka kitchen, tried knocking on a few doors, seeing if you could get some scraps of food, and then sleeping in the cow field, I don't think we'd last very long. I don't think we'd get very far. You can try it, but I don't think no, in fact, don't try. Don't try it. It would be bad for you, and it would be bad for Padmaloka Serlingham relations. But even though we can't do that, we can ask ourselves, how do we apply the principle of simplifying our lives so that we can dedicate ourselves more to breaking those fetters, so we can dedicate ourselves more to Dharma practice? So what are the things that we identify with? What are the things that we cling to? Is it our name? Is it our status of some sort? Is it membership of other groups? Is it material possessions? Are there things that we feel like we can't live without? And is our hanging on to those things, is it keeping us locked in a fixed view of ourselves? Is it preventing us from deepening our experience of life? So a couple of caveats to that. I think it is a really important area to look at. Especially because we do live in such a materialistic culture and we're encouraged to acquire things and to consume things. But nevertheless, we have to remember that first point that the Buddha made, that Dharma practice is gradual. So we're in it for the long haul. Yeah? So the voyage that we're on, it has to be sustainable. So there might be things that we could let go of, but there might be things that actually we need in order to be a happy, healthy human being who's capable of making progress. But it requires a lot of honesty in that area. And secondly, in order to give things up and let go of things, we need a sense of what it is, a strong sense of what it is we're moving towards, of what it is that we're letting go into. So I'll say more about that in a moment when we look at the next four qualities. But just to summarise what's been said so far, the Buddha's description of Dharma practice, the qualities of Dharma life, that compare to the great ocean, they suggest four principles that we might adopt in our Dharma life so that we can be persistent because the path is gradual. We can be structured, having a particular set of practices and sticking to them. We can be engaged because nobody can do it for us. And we can be transformative. So we can be willing to allow practice to change us. We can be willing to let go of things in order to keep going. So moving on to the next four qualities then. So to me it seems, to use a maritime term, it seems that the Buddha changes tack here. So the qualities he's described so far give us some practical information, how to practice the Dharma effectively. But it seems like the last four is saying more, it's saying less about the path itself and more about the fruits of practice, where the path leads. So there seem to be these last four qualities more about what we might encounter as a result of our effective practice of the Dharma. If you like, the less to do with steering to the deep and more about the depths themselves. So the fifth quality, the Buddha says, whatever streams fall into the great ocean, whatever rains might fall, the great ocean remains the same. It doesn't shrink and it doesn't overflow. So technically that's not true, is it? Because we've got the polar ice caps melting into the sea and the sea level rising. But the Buddha's speaking in terms of simile and not scientific truth, so we can dismiss that technicality. And the Buddha goes on to say that the ocean remains the same, and likewise, nirvana, enlightenment, remains the same. So no matter how many people realize nirvana, no matter how many people realize awakening, nirvana itself doesn't shrink or overflow. It remains the same. That's really mysterious. So the Buddha seems to be implying that nirvana doesn't become a personal possession. It's not something that's acquired by an individual. It's not something you take from and add to yourself. Nirvana doesn't diminish. But at the same time, he's saying that you don't kind of merge into it. It's not like it gets bigger in a you sort of shape. Or anything like that. So it's quite mysterious what the Buddha's saying here. And especially so given what the Buddha says next. So the sixth quality is that just as the great ocean has one taste, the taste of salt, so too the Dharma has one taste, the taste of freedom. So we neither possess enlightenment, nor do we merge into it. But the Buddha says there's a taste of something. It's more subtle. There's a taste. And that taste is the taste of freedom. And it's a particular type of freedom that the Buddha's talking about here. So the Pali word translated here as freedom is vimutti. Vimutti. And this goes way beyond an ordinary sense of freedom in terms of political or civil liberties or psychological freedom even. Vimutti is specifically freedom that arises out of profound insight. Insight into the nature of reality. So it's the freedom that comes as a result of breaking the fetters, beginning with those first three I mentioned earlier. So I'll say a bit more about freedom shortly, but first the seventh and eighth qualities, and I'll put these two together. So the seventh quality, the Buddha says that the great ocean contains all sorts of gems. And in the same way, the Dharma Vinaya, the Dharma life taught by the Buddha, also contains all sorts of precious gems. So teachings like the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Noble Eightfold Path, etc., etc. He gives a list of different teachings. So that's the seventh quality. And the eighth is that just as the mighty ocean is the abode of great creatures, the Buddha says the Dharma Vinaya is also the abode of great creatures. Creatures like stream entrants, so those who've broken the first three fetters, once returners, non-returners, and arahants. So arahants are those who've realized enlightenment for themselves. So these last two qualities, seventh and eighth, to me they seem to evoke something of the beauty and something of the greatness of Dharma practice, of living a Dharma life. And it's interesting that they come at the end of the Buddha's list of qualities, especially coming immediately after his statement that the Dharma has the taste of freedom. It suggests to me at least that having tasted freedom, real freedom, vimutti, that allows us to see the true value, the true beauty of the teachings that lead there. That allows us to appreciate the greatness of those other people who have become free, what it must have taken for them to get there. So it suggests that the voyage into the depths culminates in an attitude of respect, of reverence, and of gratitude. So they're the eight qualities of the Dharma, of Dharma practice, that the Buddha likens to a mighty ocean. And hopefully looking into those eight qualities has helped us to see how, if we choose to practice the Dharma, if we choose to deepen our practice of the Dharma, we can do that more effectively. So practicing the Dharma in a way that moves us from a state of bondage, of being bound by the fetters, to a state of freedom, to tasting freedom. But there's just one more thing to go into before I finish. So I started the talk by describing the three fetters and how the fetters make us feel. So they make us feel dissatisfied, frustrated, limited. And I've talked a bit about liberation and the Buddha's description of liberation as this taste of freedom. Okay, so we've looked at some of the qualities of the Dharma life in between those two stages, those two states, to call them that. We've looked at the qualities of Dharma life in between and drawn out some practical implications. But how does that bit in the middle actually feel? Does that feel the same as being fettered? Or does that feel more like the taste of freedom? So according to the Buddha in the text that I'm drawing from, this text in the Udana, every time he mentions one of those eight qualities, he says that his followers, the bhikkhus, his followers take delight in the quality, in the Dharma life. So he describes the quality and then he says, because it's like this, followers take delight in the Dharma. So in other words, they enjoy it. The Buddha's saying that his followers enjoy living this life, enjoy practicing the Dharma. So I think we can question that. Is this the case for us? So is this our experience? Has exploring Buddhism, has practicing Buddhism, practicing the Dharma, has that always been enjoyable for us? Is it something we take delight in? And to get into that a little bit more, let's return to those two stories that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, the Odyssey and the life story of the Buddha. So in Odysseus's case, on the archetypal voyage home to Ithaca. He experienced all kinds of challenges, all kinds of hardships and difficulties. So just to give you a flavour of those, he encountered a cyclops that tore men to pieces limb by limb and devoured them like a mountain lion. He met a formidable witch called Circe who turned people into wild pigs. He had to navigate his way past sirens who tried to lure seafarers into the shallows and wreck the ships by singing and chanting sweet songs to them. And most terrifying of all, perhaps, he had to sail between two hideous sea monsters, Scylla and Charybdis, who guarded a narrow sea passage. So Scylla had 12 feet dangling in the air and 6 long necks, each ending in a grisly head with triple rows of teeth set thick and close. And on the opposite side, Charybdis was just creating this huge swirling whirlpool by sucking down seawater and then vomiting it back up. And Odysseus had to sail in between the two of them. But he did. He met all those challenges. And although he survived them and did eventually reach Ithaca, it wasn't without hardships like that. It was by no means plain sailing. And then turning to the life story of the Buddha, we know that the Buddha also faced extreme challenges. So he described how on the eve of his enlightenment, he engaged in a deep struggle. So a deep struggle, practicing meditation with all his strength to free himself from the fetters. And mythologized accounts of this episode speak of the Buddha's encounter with Mara. So Mara's a powerful kind of demon who surrounded the Buddha with a great army of grotesque-looking soldiers. So all with twisted faces, bodies covered with blood, mouths spewing vomit. And they did everything they could to disturb the Buddha's meditation. They threw rocks at him, they brought about torrential rain, breathed fire at him, strong winds, but they couldn't do anything to shake the Buddha. So he sat there motionless, unmoved. So from scenes like this, we can see that great voyages, great journeys and quests, meaningful pursuits bring challenges. That's what makes them epic journeys. That's what makes them special and extraordinary. It's the capacity to overcome difficulty that makes the likes of Odysseus in the story of the Odyssey, makes the likes of the Buddha heroes. And the Dharma life is said to be for heroes. So in a Buddhist sutra called the Ratnaguna Samchayagata, it's said of the Dharma that it's taught for the welfare of the world, for heroic spirits intended. But how then do we reconcile that with what the Buddha says in the Udana text about enjoyment? Because being assailed by Mara's hordes, even if we take that just as a metaphor for our internal processes, that hardly sounds pleasant to me. Yeah, so how do we reconcile that? Well, to attempt to answer that, let's just go back briefly to vimutti, to freedom. So vimutti, you remember, is true freedom. It's freedom from the fetters. It's the freedom that comes after profound insight into the way things are, at which time the first three fetters are broken. So those two stages on the path to enlightenment, insight and freedom, vimutti, they appear in a sequence of progressively more expansive states of consciousness taught by the Buddha and known as the spiral path. And they both come quite high up in that sequence. So insight is the 8th stage, vimutti, freedom, is the 11th. So the process actually starts way down. The spiral process starts way down before that. The spiral path begins when we respond creatively to suffering, to dissatisfaction. So in other words, the spiral begins when we respond to being stuck on the island, when we respond to being trapped in the palace. And we respond not in the old habitual reactive ways, we respond more creatively. So when we move away from that dissatisfaction and go in search of something more meaningful and fulfilling, this spiral process can begin. In the traditional language, it begins when we go for refuge, when we go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, as opposed to going for refuge to other things that can never give us lasting fulfillment. So there's this whole sweep of stages before insight and before vimutti. Yet by virtue of being on that creative spiral at all, I think there's some sense of freedom. There's some taste of freedom, however subtle that might be. And it's there because we've responded creatively to our existential situation. We've gone for refuge to the three jewels. We've started to steer for the deep. And that alone has at least a subtle taste of freedom. So whatever challenges we might meet along the way, if we keep responding creatively, if we keep practicing the Dharma effectively, if we keep the goal in mind, if we keep Ithaka in mind, if we keep enlightenment in mind, then we can overcome any challenges we might encounter. And perhaps we can increasingly find a sense of enjoyment in the whole process. So not just in those moments of peace, contentment, energy, inspiration, but also in the face of challenges and hardships and even difficulties. So we can enjoy the whole journey. We can enjoy the whole voyage because it's going in the direction of true meaning, true value and beauty, and true freedom. So I'm going to end with a poem that captures this latter point really well, I think. And appropriately, it's called Ithaka. As you set out for Ithaka, hope your road is a long one, full of adventure, full of discovery. Lystragonians, Cyclops, angry Poseidon, don't be afraid of them. You'll never find things like that on your way, as long as you keep your thoughts raised high, as long as a rare excitement stirs your spirit and your body. Lystragonians, Cyclops, wild Poseidon, you won't encounter them unless you bring them along inside your soul, unless your soul sets them up in front of you. Hope your road is a long one. May there be many summer mornings when, with what pleasure, what joy, you enter harbours you're seeing for the first time. May you stop at Phoenician trading stations to buy fine things. Mother of pearl and coral, amber and ebony, sensual perfume of every kind, as many sensual perfumes as you can. And may you visit many Egyptian cities to learn and go on learning from their scholars. Keep Ithaka always in your mind. Arriving there is what you're destined for. But don't hurry the journey at all. Better if it lasts for years, so you're old by the time you reach the island, wealthy with all you've gained on the way, not expecting Ithaka to make you rich. Ithaka gave you the marvellous journey. Without her, you wouldn't have set out. She has nothing left to give you now. And if you find her poor, Ithaka won't have fooled you. Wise as you will have become, so full of experience, You'll have understood by then what these Ithacas mean.